Lovely to see you all. Fairly decent crowd. So a topic I thought of a couple of days ago, which may be relevant to you people, is the effects of meditation on the mind and body. So as you understand, the mind and body is the mind and body energies are like independently connected. You know, the mind relies on the body, the body relies on the mind to a degree. You know, when you're looking at like levels of attachment, you know, the way they work together. And when you look at that ultimate process of karma and rebirth, you know, you can't actually break that process while, you know, that those major attachments exist between these areas. And so I'll start with the body component, the way the meditation practice, you know, affects the body process, affects one's personal energies, affects one's health, and even like small things like, you know, qi and disease process and within this kind of framework, anything which is actually physical, tangible, connected with this body, which meditation has a positive impact on. So there was a particular, this is going back quite a number of years ago, we had a close disciple here at Nolamara who was diagnosed with liver cancer. And it was quite a large cancer formation, probably about the size of a small, like small apple, resting on his liver itself, and you know, naturally it's something like that's like a, you know, major concern. And when he had the first diagnosis and scan, that he was talking it over with Achyam Brom because in a number of cases, you know, potentially, you know, at his age, he was I think he was easily late 60s, maybe 70, and you know, potentially if you let something like that go, or if you have a combination of say like unsupportive karma and you know, poor dietary practice, and even things like, you know, drug and alcohol abuse, that you are going to be, you know, your physical health is going to be compromised, and, you know, that could potentially accelerate that disease process, you know, throughout your body, and, you know, basically end your life prematurely. So what Achyam Brom actually recommended for him was to essentially, you know, because it was, you know, fairly serious dynamics, was to bump up his spiritual practice. And so what he did initially was, you know, he did a pilgrimage, and he walked from Dharmaloka here up to the monastery, and he booked into the monastery for at least a couple of weeks. He had some time up his sleeve. Aside from his family responsibilities, and so, you know, kept the eight precepts to the best of his ability, and you know, he maxed out the meditation as much as he could essentially handle on a day-to-day basis. So I think he would have cranked it up to probably at least 5-6 hours a day, and so, you know, he enjoyed the stay that he had at the monastery. He felt it was quite fruitful, and even when he went back home, and the second appointment came up with the oncologist, you know, which was accompanied by a second scan, and I think that was close to the 3 months, 3 month time duration between the first and second appointment. And one of the most amazing things that the oncologist noted from the scan was that the cancer had actually shrunk like to the size of a walnut. So in 3 months, you know, you go from the size of a small apple to the size of a walnut, which is quite significant, you know, especially professionals in that area. They know how these things develop and the kind of course they follow. So he thought that was quite amazing, and he recommended him to maintain that particular lifestyle practice to the best of his ability. But unfortunately, I don't know because I left Perth, and I didn't actually ask what happened to him, you know, like years later after I come back from overseas. But you know, the initial results were, I mean, very, very, very promising. So, you know, when we look at the power of meditation on the bodily process, you know, when we look at extreme cases, you know, like cancer and tumors, and then, you know, even middle ranked disease processes, you know, even things like like skin conditions and allergies, you know, being sensitive to certain even chemicals, having like say food intolerances, this type of thing. Many of these things, they can, it is quite possible for these things to be karmically related, and you know, they may have very, very firm causal origins, which, you know, say the average monk and nun may not be able to comprehend or see, in an instant, you know, from through sheer mind power, you just can't know something like that straight off the bat. But you know, it is possible to unlock, you know, say physical energies, physical disease processes which are being played out through the body, which have a causal connection, you know, through your mind and through your personal karma. So, you know, the mind is the like the instrument which transfers the karma through to the physical body. And you know, people can experience like a wide range of say clinical conditions and symptoms, and even an interesting one, you know, even because I was in the nursing fraternity for 2 years, but even principles like with heart disease, you know, which has developed over a number of years, where you get a thickening, an occlusion of the carotid arteries of the heart, you know, as plaque and cholesterol just slowly builds up, you know, especially over a number of years, and it was within the Mayo Clinic, this Mayo Clinic, who did a number of trials, and also the Heart Foundation, that very that primary organisation, did a number of trials with meditators and non-meditators, and amazingly, over a number of weeks, say minimum, I think it might have been a minimum, say 4 weeks plus, 4 to 6 weeks, at least, that the people who practiced meditation on a significant amount, say minimum 30 minutes plus, on a daily basis, gave rise to a cross-sectional increase in the blood flow in these vessels. So that process of atherosclerosis, the occlusion of the carotid arteries, which leads to chest pain and eventual cardiac arrest, that process was just reversing, you know, just even through just meditation alone and no medication support whatsoever, which I thought was pretty amazing, you know. And but it's just it's just pretty incredible. Even things of that scale, you can see an effect in that area. And one thing that people may actually experience for themselves personally is that as one develops one's meditation practice on a daily basis, consistently over time, over weeks and months, that if one has, quite significant, say like disease process or different symptoms in particular areas, it can even be like nervous system effects, on the body, muscular tension, and naturally allergies, and even respiratory difficulties, and asthma, which can have a purely physiological basis, maybe possibly with the structure of the body, the genetic makeup of the body, but the person who practices regularly have a greater a potential to purify their karma, which could potentially be the origin of this of the disease process, the current disease process that you see. So as you develop the practice and you move into your personality, you move into your mind, and you purify your mind in itself, and you purify the karma which is playing through your mind as a channel, moving into the body component. You have that ability to eventually cleanse one's karma, which is the origin of that particular disease process. And initially, it is quite possible that people may feel an aggravation or an increase, an initial increase in the effect of the condition. But as one accelerates the process, this karmic disease process moves it up, accelerates the experience through the mind into the body, that many people will see a subsiding of either a stabilization at least with many people, or a subsiding of the symptoms which are being displayed in the body, and even quite serious disease process from the intermediate to the advanced level. And I don't know, a thought which came up in my mind, which I couldn't find any references for, was even with experiences of like stroke, or neurological disturbances which are slightly more workable. A person could be suffering from tremors, or involuntary shaking, or vision disturbances, this type of thing. Neurological disturbances like epilepsy, which is a classic, that some people can actually a stabilization, especially with things like epilepsy, which are potentially quite dangerous. If a person takes a heavy fall and they just really, really crack their head on tiles, or like a slab, they can crack their skull and do an incredible amount of damage. But I've heard of cases in the past where people have been able to say, minimize the frequency of seizures and minimize the severity of both, you know, so both small and grand mal seizures. You know, there is documentation on the web that you can look into, and because some people don't respond, you know, even some people are like in the too hard basket, and even under the best neurospecialists, they just don't. You just can't get 100% control. But when you, through the meditation practice, develop this ability to increase the power of the mind and increase, you know, brain wave stability and rhythm, and increase the, you know, the nervous system stability and tranquility, you may see a very you know, like obvious so like, you know, positive effect, you know, with people with neurological disturbances or neuroleptic conditions. And you know, because as you increase the power of the mind over time, that you can develop a degree of, you know, say like a small degree of mastery over the body. And as you know, it's that classic line that that Arnold Schwarzenegger said many years ago, that he, you know, in the gym, you know, he was, you know, people are very well aware just what a high performance athlete he was. And you know, he mentioned previously that in the gym, you know, even during like very, very intense workouts, that his mind was much stronger than his physical body. That that, you know, he could push himself to the point where he would almost physically pass out. And he, you know, he wasn't actually afraid within himself to actually pass out during very, very strenuous sets in the gym, because he was so so highly motivated, was so you know, so driven to succeed within the bodybuilding fraternity. And so like other areas of say the physical say health of the body, I think obvious things like say like tension, excessive say muscular tension or even nervous tension being say displayed, or you know, through the through the muscles and through the tendons and the ligaments in the body, that we, you know, we find that especially when people get stressed, or they're under say like emotional pressure, if we don't have this ability to resolve those energies or work those energies out of one's system, that the actual tension, the emotional tension, can get locked up in the physical structure of the body. And so this both, you know, mental, emotional tension being locked up, you know, in the muscle, you know, the nervous pathways, that particular energy. And by developing the relaxation and tranquility of mind, that will actually display itself in the body as well. And one thing that people do see, and there's also a link to Qigong in this regard, that when a person develops the practice on a regular basis, that the flow of qi, both the intensity and the quality of the qi, tends to increase with meditation practice. And because as the physical body relaxes, the physical energy tends to run more smoothly through the chi networks and meridians in the physical body. And you know, chi kung masters will tell you that when pain arises in the body, that's a very strong, you know, within their understanding, a strong indication that energy is actually blocked at that point. And you know, when they're working with people and treating people, that they focus on exercises which open up and force, you know, probably in a more gentle way, force energy through those networks and to unblock the particular channels, because I've seen it documented that they say not only physical pain, but the physical diseases, like classics like cancer or something of similar category or severity can display itself in that particular part of the body. And I'll move on to the mind component. And as many of you are well aware, there's a lot of study and research on different websites in relation to the way the meditation contributes to one's quality of life in many different areas. And so when we look at, I'm quite a fan of the meditation practice. And I usually, I never do less than, say, nothing incredible, but maybe nothing less than, say 4 to 5 hours on a daily basis. And but many of you, you know, the most obvious things that you see with, you know, from the beginning to the intermediate level, is the increasing, say, peacefulness and tranquility of mind. And, you know, that sense of mental ease and relaxation which comes from the tranquilization of both, say, thinking processes and the reduction of, emotional tensions, or, you know, like very, very strong emotions which are running through the mind. And so when we see this, when we have this kind of experience, a settling of both thinking and emotion on the level of the mind, you can induce this very deep state of relaxation and tranquility. And essentially, you know, this is directly related and tangible to your personal happiness and sense of ease and well-being. And something which is quite obvious to most of you is that when there is actually that sense of calm and ease in the mind, you know, like having an obvious sense of peace, peace of mind, that, you know, that is the happiness, that is the true happiness which is available to all human beings, you know, regardless of how poor, how wealthy, how beautiful, how plain, how much material stuff you got, you have. And so regardless of your station in life, that you all have this deep potential for real, you know, developing real happiness as a human being. And, you know, not just developing contentment and a sense of balance in the mind, but, you know, that ability to really sharpen your wisdom faculty and develop a deep understanding of your own nature and the, you know, the characters of the and the dispositions of the people around you and the events that you see, you know, in the world, you know, the stuff you see on the television and you know, on the radio and on the web, you know, which is directly, which has its direct origin and roots in the minds of human beings, and it's largely the you know, the emotional experience, you know, the emotional energies in the minds of people, which drives their thinking process and which drives the you know, the direction and the disposition and actions of human beings in general society. And when you have individuals who are hopefully successful meditators and, you know, reasonably peaceful, calm, tolerant individuals, that they are the, they are like the, they are the jewels of the human population. You know, these are the people who go through their lives and essentially inflict the minimum level of collateral damage on the human population, both on the community level and international. So, and, you know, and but you know that principle of the wisdom component, you know, really really cuts the ice, because when you look what, you know, what's actually going on around the world and these incredibly intelligent people that we see in the political arena or within the say the armed forces, especially, you know, those two categories, you know, you have people who are moving in a direction which is not necessarily beneficial to the rest of you know, both maybe the general population, like far, you know, either far or near, but you know, having the Buddha's say exposition on the, you know, the development of a human being, you know, if you have just one individual, say for example, this kind of thing is not to be underestimated. You have one individual within a, say, like a factory or a business or an office who's very peaceful, you know, tolerant, kind, easygoing, and they've got a real tangible sense of happiness. You know, they're a person who is, you know, is genuinely, I mean, happy within themselves. And, you know, this is not to be underestimated, because all of you know all the, you know, the different ways that we can essentially gratify and, you know, essentially gratify ourselves on whatever level, you know. But, you know, if you want, you know, if you're looking for the real deal, you know, if you want something which is really deep and profound and tangible, that meditation is the key to, you know, accessing those very deep states of mind, you know, both on the level of peacefulness and wisdom. And so, you know, as we develop the practice, you know, what other areas do we see, you know, like outside of, you know, just say emotional well-being? You know, what else do we actually see in our day-to-day experience? So, you know, naturally, you know, if you're looking at the testing ground, you know, so like your work environment, you know, it's all very nice to be peaceful, you know, on the cushion, you know, but you know, but what, you know, I mean, how do people respond when, you know, they're really under pressure? You know, if you really want to see the quality of a person, the quality of a character, the strength of the, you know, the practice, you know that's when you know when they're under pressure and things are difficult, and when you go home and you know, your mum and dad's, you know, completely against you, you know, they want you, you know, out of robes, so you've got your, you know, maybe your brother is just going right off at you when he, you know, when he drinks, or, you know, you suspect that he might be using meth because he's going really nuts. You know, you think to yourself, you know, how do I deal with this? You know, when I look at my practice, how do I respond to these kind of conditions? And so for example, in a work environment, that the obvious benefits that we see, you know, during the working hours, is the ability to sustain one's I hardly ever use this word concentration. It's not a very precise term. The ability of a person to apply their attentiveness, their mindfulness to their daily tasks and responsibilities. You know, what is the quality? What is the sharpness of the mindfulness and attention to detail, the ability to sustain focus even in the midst of distraction and noise and incoming emails and phone calls and this and that. You know, how quickly can you switch? You know, how quickly can you switch and multitask and actually sustain that sharpness of attention, you know, continuously, you know, for hours and hours and hours on end? And you know, what is the sharpness, the speed of the mind? You know, is that person easily, you know, flustered? You know, when the pressure's on, are they emotionally and mentally stable? You know, are they, you know, is the wisdom faculty, you know, when you're problem solving, when you're dealing with stuff or maybe difficult issues or clients on the phone, I mean, how effective are you? How productive are you? You know, is your work performance actually moving to a higher level? And so, you know, that's something which is a little bit more intense, but, you know, it's well worth paying attention to. You know, getting peaceful on the cushion is easy. You know, actually, I wouldn't say that. It's much easier to deal with. But, you know, what is it like when the boss is expecting us to meet that deadline within 24 hours or that afternoon? You know, can we deliver the goods, so to speak? And so the actual qualities, you know, of your mind, the level of mental energy you have, you know, can you actually sustain energy without, you know, relying on endless cups of tea or coffee to keep you going? I mean, some people who have decent meditation, you know, have energy on tap without stimulants, and can actually sustain the energy of the mind for long periods, for hours on end, without tiring. And you know, they build up the energy in the samadhi practice. And you know, it is possible for people to go easily for half a day and to still feel quite bright and mentally energetic. And naturally, I don't expect people to be like, you know, Superman, Superwoman. Most people are glad to see the end of one's day. But usually people who, the regular meditators, you know, they've always got something in reserve. You know, if you push them to do 12 hours, 14, 16 hours a day, you know, they can do it. You know, they can do it every second day. And they can do it for weeks on end without falling exhausted into bed, you know, just through the drain of one's work. So also in other areas, a thought which came up was the advantages that that students see, especially like international students and college and university students who may have time to do practice for maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day. You know, what kind of results do they see when they're in the classroom, face-to-face lectures or the library? The most, the obvious signs they see are increased attention span. So, the ability to sustain one's focus in a lecture format, to sustain the quality of one's attention. So, one can pay attention, but what is the quality of the attention? How sharp is the mindfulness? How attentiveness? Are you giving, are you giving 100%? Or, have you got this kind of laxy-daisy, maybe 40, 50, I'm paying attention, but I'm not really listening. I'm half there, I'm looking at you, I'm listening, but I'm not giving it absolutely everything, like full mind power, which is quite a tall order. But people who've got really, really, really good meditation, when you chit chat with them, they are focused, absolute minimum, 90-95% of everything they've got. And when they hear everything, the, not just the words, but the full emotional experience that you convey on a moment-to-moment basis, and they see you as a person to a very deep level, not just a surface personality, but they see, they see the teenager, they see the child in that person, in that adult, in that person 60, 70, 80 years of age. They can see the child, the 12, 13 year old child who was traumatized, who was kicked out of home, and that's the kind of depth and sort of profundity of samadhi, when you're actually looking deeply into another person's nature when you engage them. And so other principles which students can experience is the naturally the sharpening of the sense faculties, but also the sharpening of one's insight capability. So naturally, this is something which is very, very useful when you have like a lecturer. Most lecturers are experienced professionals. They are people who've been doing, giving academic deliveries, been giving tutorials, substantial talks and essays, minimum 30, 45 minutes, an hour at a stretch on a regular basis. Any experienced academic tutor, who's at the university level, these people are skilled in giving talks. And so, for example, you have a student who's who's a meditator, you develop an increased ability to actually absorb a greater degree of the delivery of the person who's delivering the talk, the essay, the tutorial. So on a surface and on a more deeper intuitive feely kind of basis, you get a greater sense of what the teacher or the lecturer is trying to convey. You know, these people are professionals. They, you know, they're expected to know their subject to quite a deep level. You know, much deeper than the average of any person like walking the street. And so, by having that sharpness of senses of faculty, that you've got the ability to actually take in, far more of that person's delivery to gain the benefit of what that person is trying to convey to you. So essentially, you're getting more of the goods. You know, if you've got a person who's a regular meditator, a person who's got no mindfulness training at all, that the meditator will actually have a greater sensitivity and awareness of the lecturer's delivery, so to speak. And so with another, say, facet which comes to mind is the mental health fraternity. And I was in mental health for about 12 months total, both in chronic and acute setting. And even with people who come through the monastery or the smaller community groups, and even within Dhammalokya here, that you're going to have people with mental health issues or symptoms who can actually benefit from the practice. And naturally, you need to be a little bit more careful with people who have quite pronounced emotional difficulties or irregularities in the thinking process or delusions or paranoia or potentials for psychosis. If I have somebody who's with symptoms who's interested in learning the practice, I always tend to keep a fairly close eye on them. I just don't give them tools and techniques for meditation and then just leave them to their own device, because for some people it can be like opening the devil's workshop. That person is going into their mindset, and if it's a little bit hocus pocus in there, if it's not particularly stable, initially the symptoms may possibly be exacerbated. So you try to relay techniques which give like reasonably good results over time, and things like loving kindness and compassion are quite safe. The breath meditation is like reasonably safe, but I always I always like check in with people, make sure they're okay, they're within a safe range, because as some of you know, that the top consulting psychiatrist from the Metta Clinic in Sydney that I had a chit chat with many years ago, he would not teach his clients meditation, even though he'd been a practicing Buddhist and a meditator for 30 years, and because there are potential dangers. Some people can potentially they can become more deluded. They can induce a psychosis with meditation initially. So you need to be a bit careful, and you need to let them know that right from the beginning, that if they're interested in meditation, into getting some peace of mind, getting some freedom from delusion, getting some clarity of mind, that, you know, if things start to go topsy-turvy and they get an exacerbation of symptoms, that essentially they've got to stop right there. And even if they're interested, you know, have a continued interest in meditation, it's best to recommend the process, the wisdom practice, the investigation that, you know, that person should look into their thought processes, their feelings, their delusions, and try to understand the way the experience actually arises and in the mind and potentially can take them over, where they just get lost in this this kind of stuff, which we feel is not within, say, like a normal what's the right words? It's not like a normal range of experience. All of us have a bit of madness in the mind. All of us have this crazy chatter that you can see, and which is quite obvious. But the person with say paranoid schizophrenia or delusions or this or that activity is like right in their face, and it's so strong that they don't have any distance from it, and it can just take them right over. So they just get lost in this stuff. And even within my own mind, I mean, I can just look at this stuff, but I've got lots of space between me and this kind of crazy chatter. And I can, you know, I can settle it. I can settle my mind like reasonably quick. But the average, the person with mental health issues, they can get completely lost in this material. But, you know, things like loving kindness and compassion are very, very safe. If you've got someone who's even like really intense, but they're interested in practice, this kind of practice is quite safe. Radiating loving feelings towards oneself, towards other people. So, you know, and compassion, you know, very, very strong feelings of compassion for oneself and for others. You know, it develops this very positive, altruistic, you know, soft and supportive kind of mindset, and it's reasonably safe. You know, I've never heard of anyone who'd gone completely nuts or completely spacko on compassion meditation, and it helps that kind of principle. Loving kindness and compassion, it helps to shape the mind and shape the emotional experience of the person, which is the driving force, which is the energy which drives your thought processes. And so let me think now. So with the just an example where an individual, but this is just a thought which came up. This is not a judgment in any way, but it shows you the power of the mind and a person's karma as well. And you're a very, very senior monk years ago who had who developed a psychosomatic condition. And I won't go into details. And this person was a very experienced meditator and been teaching for a number of years, and very, very familiar with people's difficulties and their personal issues, and would counsel people, and was teaching full time. And that person was actually afflicted by a psychosomatic condition, which essentially didn't leave him and persisted for months, and actually started to impinge and affect the quality of his meditation practice. And this is very much a key principle, especially with the monastics, that when the quality of the meditation is quite good, you can die in the robes. If the meditation It's like the weak link, you know, in the chain. When you look at the attributes, the qualities of your life, both on the lay level, within the monastic form, and especially with the monastics who say ordain in a meditative tradition, the meditation in itself, on both sides, both on the level of samadhi and insight, it's quite crucial. And when the meditation starts to fall apart, that's when people start to die in the robes. I used that kind of word to convey a sense of that. You know, when you have somebody practicing 20, 25, 30 years, you know, like I'm coming up to 19, say 20 years next year, and I really understand how these people feel when they're very, very close to that point. And even for myself, I never, ever judge any monk or nun who leaves after 5, 10, you know, 20, 30 years. You know, some lay disciples, they shake their heads. They just can't believe these people can go. But I can understand, you know, quite easily how they can leave. But it's when you look at the quality of the practice and the power of the mind, the ability to protect oneself from one's own defilements. You know, you don't have to, you know, blame anyone else or pin the responsibility on external conditions. You just have to look within yourself at the nature of your own mind. And when you, whether you're a lay practitioner, whether you're a monastic, you know, regardless of if it's an intense experience at the intermediate or the high level, that your mind experience, you know, the supporting faculties that you have, that you've developed within your mind, will dictate whether you are going to cut the ice or whether you're going to fall apart or you know, look for assistance maybe in another area. Because you know, a lady told me the other day, she's a regular meditator, but she was going through some very, very some heavy issues with her daughter. And you know, and she, this lady's training to be a counsellor, and you know, she's very well clued in, but it was getting a little bit too heavy, and she pulled you know, some people in. She was quite prepared to go to professionals for advice and support, and she was able to smooth that particular experience over within a short space of time. So. On the level of the mind, as we develop the practice, one thing that you actually see, as with the increasing refinement of your faculties, it might sound a little bit funny to you that it's something you might expect with the monastics, for the monastics to develop some refinement of mind, to develop some purity of mind, and you people would actually expect that, you know, where the monks and nuns are supposed to be like professional meditators, and so, but with the lay disciples, it's something which is also tangible for yourself, you know. So you develop this very basic practice, the breath meditation, you know, it could be loving kindness, obviously, and could be mantra. Mantra meditation, that you are going to see an increase in the refinement of both the mind faculties and your emotional experience. So when you actually look within yourself, from this, say, the very, very simple breath meditation, you can develop say like half a dozen of refined underlying qualities, things like patience, naturally kindness, compassion, equanimity, things like tolerance, and the ability to actually listen and to take a person's experience in when you engage people. So, you know, there's a number of, you know, there's easily a couple more which don't come to mind at the moment, but you're looking at an increase in the and refinement in the emotional qualities of the person. And, you know, that's something I see with people who've come to the monastery who may be quite irritable or angry, but they persevere. And then 6 months later, 12 months later, you see this, you know, relatively smiling, happy, you know, person who's relaxed and at ease, and they're actually comfortable with themselves and their family, you know, their children. They notice, you know, this quite, you know, they see this quite clearly as the months go by with the practice. So, you know, over time, this refinement and sensitivity, increased understanding and wisdom faculty of the mind, and gradually, so as we develop these core foundation principles, all these foundation principles are orientated and they are geared to take you to the highest level of the practice, and essentially, you know, you're moving and you're working towards the breakthrough, hopefully, you know, the enlightenment stages. All the work that you put in on a day-to-day basis, you know, the precepts, and the chanting, the generosity, the meditation practice, developing insight, developing wisdom, you know, this is all moving towards supporting you towards, you know, breaking through to the enlightenment stages, to these very, very profound insights, which will essentially sever and shorten the this rebirth process in samsara. So I'll end the talk right there. And if I can open the floor to questions or arguments or whatever, please feel free.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I love meditation. And I thoroughly get so many benefits. My mind just clears and I go into bliss and it's wonderful. However, at times I feel that I need dynamic chanting, especially when I'm wanting to help somebody. Like my daughter was going through a very difficult situation. She was crying to me. I sat down and I chanted for her for half an hour. She rang me back and she said, "Mum, you've been chanting," and because the situation had been resolved. So could you talk a little bit about chanting, the benefits of chanting, and when, you know, the difference between the vibrational difference between chanting and meditation? Thank you.
That's a really good one. So with the chanting experience, when we look at the, you know, if we look at the mind experience, when you're actually developing your chanting ability, developing your mind power in this area, you know, it's completely correct that you, through the power of your mind, through the say, like a chanting sequence, you have the ability to essentially radiate like energy from the mind. And as all of you are familiar, I've never actually checked this on the web to any great degree, but you know, like chanting has an emotional vibrational component, and you have that. You know, if you're quite skilled or you've practiced chanting over time, you know, maybe at least several weeks or several months, you have an ability to radiate energy from your mind to those, especially those people who are close to you, because you know when you have close family, and these people are karmically close, you have karmic relationships, very very firm connections with these people, and so you have an ability to to establish like a mind-to-mind connection. So it's far more likely that you will be able to help someone who's very close to you, mum and dad, sons and daughters, close friends, greater potential to reach people like that on a mind-to-mind level than possibly complete strangers. And this is a slight sidetrack, but as many of you are familiar with Qi Gong's being the ability to transfer energy and heal at great distances, even the ability to, you know, from a photograph to heal a person in another country, you know, if they know the location, they have the person's identity, they can heal, you know, things like cancers and arthritis, you know, really, really solid diseases from a distance by channeling and focusing energy. You know, people who at that level, Qi Gong masters, possibly people who do, so like Tai Chi masters who develop these skills, and people who really chant, you know, every single day, like 30 minutes minimum. You know, I would never underestimate these people's ability to essentially focus energy and to help others on both a physical or emotional level, and those people who are close to you are more likely to feel that vibration, that loving vibration, that supportive vibration. It could be even particular sutras. One's daughter is in hospital, and you know she's delivering her first baby. Brothers or sisters who can't actually be there at the hospital, they could be even overseas or interstate. You know, they have skills in chanting, you know, long-term experience with chanting, that you know they can focus and you know channel energy, protective chanting to protect their sibling and their child during the birth process, and these things are quite possible, and it's something I believe I could take on board without a problem whatsoever. And people can also chant for their pets, you know, for example a pet could be in at a veterinary clinic, or people can chant for their workmates, you know, even before they go into work, they can infuse energy into the location where they work, the factory, the business, and you know you may find that quite interesting, because if you can increase the positive energy where your, you know, where your workplace is. You may actually even be able to infuse your workmates with this kind of radiance. So essentially, you know, you're looking at the ability to develop like power in the mind, energy in the mind, and direct it through the verbalization of different trance, different sutras, different protective could be even protective mantras. Each tradition has a set of mantras that you could choose in this way.
Thank you. Actually, I teach Qigong and yoga and Tai Chi, and I chant every day, I meditate every day, and I'm just very grateful for my life and to be here amongst all these beautiful people. And yeah, it's just, life is wonderful. Thank you.
And were there any other questions at all? So I'll just have a quick... Question one, Christine from Malta. That's where my granddad used to come from. I'd like to be free from attachments like food, alcohol, cravings. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes not, especially in the festive season in the Western world. Does meditation help to ease such cravings? So, it certainly would, but, it may take a bit of time to kick in. It depends on your personality and how strong the desires are, but meditation does help to ease and settle desires to a small degree. You know, I mean, I never ever underestimate the power of sensual desire, because this is what really drives human beings, and drives the world. It spins the world. But you should easily see some relief. Say, for example, you were going to like a party, and you knew people were going to, they were really going to hit the wine, the spirits, the beers, and massive, really, really like deluxe buffet with everything there. And you knew within yourself, you had to be very, very careful with the alcohol, and just go a bit steady with the calories, because you might be a little bit tubby. So you could actually meditate for maybe 30 minutes. I mean, that's quite beefy, 30 minutes, and then go to the party engagement, and then you should at least get a sense of, it should easily take the edge off the craving, the desire, for food, for beverages, and because you're helping to tranquilize those sensual feelings. Most people can see, it tends to take the edge off the experience, but I would never ever say that it's going to sort of eliminating completely. That would be too much to ask. But something interesting which just popped up in my mind. I heard a case of two meditators who went to a party, and it was a great party, and there were lots of good people and great food, and the music was fantastic and whatnot. And these were middle-aged guys in their, say, late 40s, and they both got a little bit tanked up, and they knew they were, because of the increased underlying awareness, they knew they were intoxicated. They could feel it. It was quite obvious. And so as they were chit-chatting, they said, why don't we do an experiment? We'll step outside, we'll go into the garden, and we'll sit meditation for 20 minutes, just quietly in the garden, in a corner section. And they did that, and these guys were experienced meditators. They'd both been going minimum 10 years. And so they sat for 20 minutes, and as they came back into the party fraternity, that they could see an obvious drop in the level of the intoxication. And, you know, previously where they knew they were unsteady as they stepped out, when they came back in, they felt much sharper and actually felt, they didn't feel that their faculties were actually impaired to the point where they were actually unsteady, or they couldn't think straight, or they couldn't make, say, drive a vehicle. Naturally, you know, when people are drinking, you know, anything's possible. But, you know, these guys have been going for 10 years and they actually felt an obvious sharpening of this sense faculty. So even if you find within yourself where you get compromised, where you might be drinking, you could have a couple of drinks and you know that you've got to drive, or you're driving people home who are really, you know, really smashed, but you've only had maybe 2 beers, 3 beers, that, you know, you can sit meditation for minimum 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and you do this to sharpen your mind, sharpen the mindfulness, protect yourself and protect your friends and get home safely. Question 2, James from the UK. Is indulgence... that's a funny one. I haven't got my reading glasses on here. Is indulgence in sexual pleasure a hindrance to jhana? Yes, it is, very much. And I can promise you that none of you guys will ever get jhanas. If you are hot for the opposite sex, you will never, ever get in. So, and that's the monastics as well. This, with the hindrances, the two big ones which come up, a sensual desire and aversion, irritation, anger, hate. These are the two hard cookies of the five hindrance format, as many of you are aware, from memory, is it sensual desire, aversion, doubt, sloth and torpor, restlessness and something scruples, in relation with the precepts, infringement on infractions of precepts. But the big ones which come up with people, it's sensual desire and aversion. You know, those other three, they're very, very mild, but those two, that's really what stops people from getting into very, very deep meditation. And so, but naturally, you know, with the lay community, you know, you vast majority of you are sexually active, and if you're not, you're quite welcome to come to the monastery and ordain, because you're already halfway there. If you're celibate out there, you can join the club, and stay with us. So, but you know, it's not to be underestimated. The sexuality, it's an incredibly powerful force, and it can reach you and touch you in so many different ways and forms. So, you know, if we indulge in sexuality, or we like to play, and we like to, you know, to play with different people at different times, you know, you might find that it just really ruins your practice. You know, it's much more conducive, you know, that you find someone who's really, really compatible with you, and whose company you really enjoy. You know, you enjoy the person intellectually, emotionally, and in addition to sexuality, but to have a person who really, really fits the big picture, but playing around, you know, that really will like destroy your practice, because it's not just the sexuality, but it's also the worry and the concern, you know, with your precepts. And the worry and concern that you could, you know, get HIV, or you could get gonorrhea, or you know, or syphilis, or all sorts of nasty, you know, UTIs. So if their partners find out, if they're married people, or or you don't really know this person's background. They could be a drug user. They could have hepatitis. You know, you really don't know what you're getting if you pick people up on the web. And you could be a very, very good person, a bit free and easy, but you could just get unlucky and get some very, very nasty disease process which persists. So yeah, personally, I'd avoid it. If you're a person who's it's quite perfectly normal. You want relationships with the opposite sex. I mean, just try to find someone who's very close to your own level, who's a meditator, who's a Buddhist, who likes to do the things that you do. And you can form a strong connection through shared interests and then really get to know that person and share your life with that person. So, were there any other questions at all before I pass it over to this young lady here?